ARPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 7.
My visit to Sorrento was repeated many times, always in the springtime, when the place was alive with a myriad of birds, and like an orange garden with the flower scents. At that period, houses were few, and I believe that Mr. Coppin was busy with his plans for popularizing this seaside resort. That popularity has brought about changes, but the old Sorrento I knew is still my first love of all the places I have been. For there I learned to know the sea, and to find in it responses of my own nature, its restlessness, urgency, and ever-varying lights and sounds, beneath which was always the constant struggle to go further and further, and to win against obstacles. Yet a third phase of experience was presented to me during this period. My cousin in Sydney opened her home and heart to me, and off I went. On the jag, as some folk I met over there described it. Of course, Sydney, with its shrieking ferries and echoing harbour, was very new ground, and I greatly enjoyed the many jaunts I had with Nell and her friends. We did the rounds of the family, picnicked at beaches and romped around generally. My cousin's husband was a seafaring man, Captain John Herbertson, and most of the members of their circle were attached to the sea in some way. Now it should be remembered that I had lived in a Puritan atmosphere from the day of my birth, and had been so sheltered that nothing of the Bohemian life had ever come under my notice. Here in Sydney I had my eyes opened. My objection to a kiss from a boy just home after months at sea was the subject of great hilarity. A little spree was to be tolerated after the hardships of a long voyage, in which abstinence had been compulsory. I hardly knew where I was, but one day cleared it all up for me. A lad who had left his ship with a lot of money belonging to the company had lost it while indulging in a few at the pub, and landed at my cousin's door in a most pitiable plight, and agonized with shame and remorse and the expectation of disgrace. He had nowhere to go, no friends in the state, no money to pay for food and lodging, and Nell could not turn him out. During 3 terrible days we stood by, waiting for the police. The unhappy boy could not eat or sleep, but tramped the house and yard, unable to make up his mind whether to give himself up to the law or to the oblivion of the harbour just below. At last it was agreed that I should stay at home with him, in case anything happened, while my cousin went to the office of the company whose money had been lost. Truly we feared he might destroy himself, for he had good antecedents and dared not go home in disgrace. At the office, my cousin was informed that some friendly stranger had picked up the bag of money and had delivered it safely to the manager. What a relief was this news! And now it only remained to get the boy back to his home in another state. Nell found the fare, and sighed comfortably as she said, "Well, that's all over, but I bet he will catch us scragging from his dear mamma." Perhaps you understand what was borne in upon me then. These gay, feasting, happy-go-lucky, not too fastidious people of the sea had different ways from those of my church-going family, but what hearts they had! It was anything but frivolous conduct, this giving shelter to a boy in such trouble. They had accepted the fact that naughty boys are more in need of friends than good ones, and after that I felt less affronted at a bit of rough play, or at a lad who grew a trifle sentimental after a glass of liquor. Not that I like such things, but tolerance should always increase with the years. No attempt is made in this story to catalogue events and dates in their exact order, but I shall add to the record another event which affected me deeply, the death at 33 of my sister, Eliza Crocker. She had been the last sister in our home and had helped with the household duties. Then she had married and settled near us, keeping always in close touch. the arrival of her three children provided us with little thrills, and her Monday visits to us were almost festive occasions. Then the fourth babe was expected, and very hard times made it more of a shadow than the advent of the others. The winter was very cold, and in June Lizzie fell ill, having taken a severe chill. The little boy came before his time, and dire sickness gripped the mother. For 6 weeks she fought the battle, for she was a happy wife and mother, and wanted to live for her husband and children. In 3 weeks the infant died, and our sister soon knew that she must follow. It was a violent time when we laid her to rest, and the pitostrums were beginning to show waxy clusters. I was convinced that death at her age, and with such reasons for living, was not natural. Medical science can now cope with cases like hers, and for that I rejoice when I remember the bitter grief we suffered that winter. This was the first of 6 of Mother's children to pass on, not including the 2 who had gone before I was born. The break was a hard one to face, presenting, however, some lessons not to be learned in any other way. I refused to blame God for the blow, and found myself afterwards on a much firmer rock of understanding the principles of human destiny, and fixed in a stronger faith in the righteousness of the Almighty in his dealings with men. So I came through this, and many other trying experiences, as the years slipped by in work and play, in growth of mind, and in the development of interests and friendships. Something should be said about my amusements in those days. Of course, a church concert was common enough, and we had socials and sing-songs in the various guilds and clubs to which I belonged. It was about this time that I broke through the taboos of my set and went to my first opera, Aida. The impressions made upon me were remarkable. I loved the music, and the rather banal story was new to me then, but I came to the end of the play with a sense of the ridiculous, similar to that I experienced over the body in the bag in Rigoletto. The dying lovers, warbling rapturously to each other in their lethal vault, smote right in the belt my practical realism, especially when the friend who was with me whispered, "The walls of the vault are bulging in and out in the draught from the wings." Since that first visit to the theatre, I have gone occasionally, when the play was attractive and the actors good, for fine voice production, whether in song or spoken words, is always entertainment to me. I took in my programme a totally different type of amusement, and one which would doubtless shock my highbrow friends. This was the variety show at the Temperance Hall every Saturday night. The seats were priced at 3p, 6p, and a shilling, and I chose the cheapest. There in the back rows gathered the Herald boys and other tough lads, about 20 of them, and they provided me with all the fun I needed. They were bold fellows, loud in their comments on everything that presented itself, either on or off the stage. They scuffed their feet if the items didn't suit them. They joined in popular choruses, often substituting their own witty parodies for the author's words. They discussed their personal doings, with much frankness, right behind my shoulder, and laughed raucously at each other's smartness. One night there was a deserter from our ranks, and just before the program started, in came Billy with a lady friend. I hope Billy liked it when a shout rang through the hall. "There he goes with his Donna, and by gosh, he's gone to the shillinish seats. Bill's a swell tonight." My right to occupy the seat in front of this group was never challenged, and I kept matters safe by a small bribe now and then. The lemonade man would appear with his basket, and a couple of bottles at my expense would always go round among the young gallants. But soon I discontinued the lemonade, as bottle rolling, with considerable noise, became prevalent, and I feared that the management would throw us all out, so I chose peanuts instead. That was at least a quieter form of hospitality, for although I could hear vigorous munching, I'm sure the audience did not miss any of the program on account of it. Many a happy night I sat on those back benches. After years, I absolutely forget the singers and the comedians who occupied the stage, but the larks of those boys still give me a smile whenever I turn back to that page. Their behavior was consistently decent, and only once did I hear a lapse into bad language, and it was speedily squelched by the other lads who cried, "Shut up! Don't you see the respectable ladies out in front?" I'm glad I had not to clean up the temperance hall after these little sprees. Returning once more to the developmental side of this part of my life, I should like to include here two extracts from my previous literary work, which were inspired at the time. It is so often stated that when blind people express an admiration for the beautiful and claim that they have much enjoyment from it, that they are merely relations of Sir Echo. In this matter, it is difficult to be clear and convincing, but the first extract may offer food for thought to some. I was walking in the gorge at Launceston with my friend Mrs. Hunt, and she grew pitiful because she supposed I could not enjoy that lovely spot. Later, I embodied the gist of our conversation in a poem, entitled The Power of Beauty, and here are a few stanzas from it. "Then," I began, "your wish is now fulfilled, dear friend, and on my mind is laid the scene. I have beheld the gentle town-clad hills, and rugged grandeur too of this ravine. All by your words impressed, yet I say that ere you spoke I knew the place was fair, for knowledge of its loveliness had sunk deep, deep within my soul to linger there. Your words have made it vivid and more clear, each detail. Yet I feel no more delight than at that sense of beauty mystical which came unaided by your clearer sight. 'Tis surely folly to assume that God has placed the only medium in the eye, whereby our inner selves receive the good found in the glories of the earth and sky. Each human sense within our bodies stored becomes the vehicle of other things, and soft impressions touch on every nerve, sending a message to their very springs. Beauty is not the vision satisfied, but something deeper planted in the soul, a longing for the spirit perfected, for something not unfinished, something whole. If not, then, why do we conceive in things invisible the type of all that's fair? What is the beauty, then, of holiness, the loveliness of mercy's tender care? Who hath beheld the mansions of the blessed? Yet heaven is our beauty's goal and end, and what more glorious than the love of God, so glorious that we cannot comprehend? If colors, pleasures, I have been denied, I feel the touch of nature on my mind, and in the roaring triumph of the flood, a victory over circumstance I find. If I were deaf and helpless, dumb and blind, I would not be an outcast from the light, for God another channel would provide, by which could enter streams of pure delight." And that was published in Maiden Verses. And now, Bird Nesting, a song from Sorrento. With merry laugh and eager hand, we picked the long clematis strand about the tea tree clinging, for we had spied some clustered bloom just spreading on its seed-time plume and ready for the winging. But when the treasures we possessed, we found a tiny songster's nest upon its stem suspended. Three pretty eggs of soft green shade within its mossy cup were laid, by shading leaves defended. And in the scrub the parent bird, calling distressfully we heard, o'er all her labour wasted. And we were sorry to have spoiled the joy for which the bird had toiled, and yet had never tasted. And that was published also in Maiden Verses. Adelaide Visits. During the period I worked at home as a music teacher, I did much public singing, appearing at as many as 40 concerts in a year to help raise money for churches, charities, and social organizations of various kinds. I cannot say that I was greatly enriched thereby, for in those times the demand upon the services of musicians for unpaid assistance was positively scandalous. Often the organizers would demur if even a 5-shilling expenses allowance were suggested, and a vote of thanks was considered adequate in return for time spent, fares disimbursed, and the cost of new music and of dress suitable for platform work. All non-star performers like myself had to submit to this banditry, or risk losing pupils, friends, or prestige. One day, however, the post brought me a letter, inviting me to go to Adelaide and sing in the town hall there on the occasion of the annual meeting of the Royal Blind Institution. Mr. Hendry, the manager, had heard me sing in the Melbourne Town Hall at a Rose show and offered to pay expenses and find hospitality for me and the additional inducement of meeting many friends, both in the blind world and outside it. This was most exciting. I made ready with gala dresses and practiced my songs, Bid Me Discourse, and Handel's Let Me Wander Not Unseen, until I could warble them with ease and confidence. And then away I went by the westbound express in search of a new experience. I shall never forget the excitement of that trip. Mr. William Finlayson was the treasurer of the Blind Institution, and he and his family entertained me during my stay in Adelaide. The concert was successful, and I received gratifying attention from the press, while every hour of the time was filled with some outing or interview. Lunch at the gardens, a picnic day among the lovely hills, a social with the blind, and visits to old and new friends made me happily weary every night, and warm with anticipation as each morning broke. I was filled with admiration at the abundant flowers, which I came in for an ample share, and the great scented oranges to be had in Melbourne shops only by the opulent few. I grew merry at the little railway train, puffing noisily through the street from the port, the bell on the engine donging incessantly to keep the line clear of the pedestrian public. Joy, novelty, petting were my portion during that delectable fortnight. One experience I like to remember especially, as some more recent happenings have revived its impressions greatly. Mr. Hendry had called up to meet the Reverend Gifford, an old friend of mine, and when this interview was over, he told me that we were invited to pay a visit to Dr. C.H. Souter, the honorary medical officer of the institution. I was told how kind and attentive he was to the needs of the blind in matters of health, and Mr. Hendry added that our host had the same hobby as myself, the game of verse writing. So we took a cab and drove to the house of the doctor, just as he was finishing his evening call of my patients. I found him a most genial gentleman, given to sly jokes and a spot or two of teasing. He made fun of himself and of me for bothering about poetry, but we managed to get a bit off on one another. I had written some lines at dawn, when travelling by train across the desert, and Mr. Hendry had his typist make a few copies, and one went to Dr. Souter, while he read or recited to me his famous Emily verses. Next we turned to music. I went to the piano and sang several songs for him, and presently I found he was joining me with his violin, improvising cleverly as I sang and played. I raked up from my memory all my Mendelssohn and Beethoven, and many trifles of the classics which I could execute, and all the while his tuneful fiddle followed the notes harmoniously. It was a very pleasant evening, and has often come back to my memory, as later I realized that the doctor was winning a place for himself among the poets of this young nation. The humor and playfulness so evident in his writings are true to the pattern of the man I met so many years ago. In due time I got back to Melbourne and to the humdrum ways of life, but I came laden with those imperishable trophies, good wishes, happy memories, and a sense of honors won, even though they were of the humblest type. Later, I had several other trips to Adelaide. One was to attend the Congress of Esperantists, and in its way it was just as rich and exciting. But no visit could be so fraught with the glamour of that first one, for it was more personal, more novel, and opened for me a totally new gate to the garden of experience. Early literary efforts. At this point in my story, it seems appropriate to say something about the early development of my literary works. With a mind full of impressions of the beauty of the world and its living people, and the desire to find self-expression in some form of art, and urged on to wipe out my failure at the university in some way, I soon began to try out my powers in original writing. Always a lover of books, and successful in my English lessons, I turned my attention to verse, although I did not neglect prose efforts as well. Poems of varying quality, some very poor as I judge them now, poured from my little simplex typewriter. Friends showed some interest in them, and suggested the publication of a small volume. My typewriter was not equal to the work of preparing this script, so my niece copied down at my dictation selections of the best, and I took them to Messina and Company. Oh yes, they would publish them for me if I paid the whole cost of £50 in advance. At first I was daunted by the magnitude of this responsibility, for I had come from a family ever afraid of taking grave financial risks. However, I knew of the subscription method of launching a book, and I sent out my circulars inviting advance orders to guarantee the cost. That was in 1901, and the book was Maiden Verses, being my first or maiden effort. The reader may guess that this attempt brought neither money nor fame, but it did pay its passage through the press, and in some quarters cast over me a glamour which I found decidedly pleasing. One really valuable service it rendered in establishing me in the Australian Literature Society, which met at Furlong Studio in the Royal Arcade, Melbourne. To the monthly meetings came many whose names still live amongst us. Mr. and Mrs. Furlong were our kind hosts, and the encouragement they gave to all was incalculable. Among the regular members, I can recall Bernard O'Dowd, a debater of the gesticulating type, always a dreamer, emphatic in expression and tenacious of his opinions, sometimes giving the president, Dr. T.P. McInerney, some genuine work in steadying up the meeting. Howlett Ross was often on hand, with fine interpretations of Gordon and other writers. One night he started on a recital of A Battlefield Funeral by Major Ray, a little gem of prose describing an episode of the Boer War. I thought to myself, this isn't much. But suddenly I discovered that my eyes were wet, and the solemn and pathetic words rolled on in Mr. Ross's glorious voice and fine style. Well, I knew that here was an artist, since he could move a young woman who giggled at the death scene in Aida and perceived something ridiculous in the dying warbles of Rigoletto's daughter. Others were there who either wrote a little or helped with papers, Mrs. and Miss Hunt, and the Malmgren sisters, and many more who have vanished from my knowledge. All these, like the Furlongs, bore on high the banner of the local writer, encouraging us to go on with the building of literature that will some day be the glory of Australia, in spite of neglect and contempt, and in the face of the absence of any financial reward. With Dr. McInerney, and with the succeeding president, the Reverend Dr. John Matthew, the distinguished writer on ethnology, I formed genuine friendships. Sometimes the genial Irish doctor would come along at the close of the meeting and say, "I think there's coffee and cakes at a place I know around the corner. Come along." And he would escort me and my companion to a supper house and overwhelm us with Desdemonas and Othellos, rich confections popular at that time, and with delicious but liver-racking coffee, thickened with cream. Wherever I met the doctor, he had something good for me. Once I was strolling around an exhibition of art, well plastered with do not touch notices. He came along by accident, and deciding that I should touch what I wished to examine, got Mr. Douglas Richardson, the sculptor, who was in charge of the show, to take me round and give me access to all the lovely carvings and sculptured exhibits. Not long before his death, this scholarly old gentleman, loyal and devout to his Church of Rome, and endowed with a natural gift of spiritual mindedness, came to visit me at my home in response to a letter of condolence I had sent him at the demise of a sister. I found his memory weakening, and missed the quick mental grasp which had always characterized him. But he still loved a joke, and we exchanged some of the old ones of former days. At parting he said, "Well, tell Tilly Aston I shall meet her again in a better life later on." And so he passed from my earthly ken. A year or two after that evening, I met old Dr. Maloney, who had sometimes come to the Australian Literature Society meetings with his friend, the doctor, and he told me that one of the chief pleasures of the future existence would be to meet Tim again. And so lovable was T.P. McInerney that there are many other people who feel the same. Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of episode 7 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.